material gain or on what's in it for me. But I believe the higher use of imagination is in harmony with the use of conscience to transcend self and create a life of contribution based on unique purpose and on the principles that govern interdependent reality. Identifying roles and goals. Of course, the logical/verbal left brain becomes important also as you attempt to capture your right brain images, feelings, and pictures in the words of a written mission statement. Just as breathing exercises help integrate body and mind, writing is a kind of psychoneuromuscular activity which helps bridge and integrate the conscious and subconscious minds. Writing distills, crystallizes, and clarifies thought and helps break the whole into parts. We each have a number of different roles in our lives, different areas or capacities in which we have responsibility. I may, for example, have a role as an individual, a husband, a father, a teacher, a church member, and a businessman. And each of these roles is important. One of the major problems that arises when people work to become more effective in life is that they don't think broadly enough. They lose the sense of proportion, the balance, the natural ecology necessary to effective living. They may get consumed by work and neglect personal health. In the name of professional success, they may neglect the most precious relationships in their lives. You may find that your mission statement will be much more balanced, much easier to work with, if you break it down into the specific role areas of your life and the goals you want to accomplish in each area. Look at your professional role. You might be a salesperson, or a manager, or a product developer. What are you about in that area? What are the values that should guide you? Think of your personal roles: husband, wife, father, mother, neighbor, friend. What are you about in those roles? What's important to you? Think of community roles, the political area, public service, volunteer organizations. One executive has used the idea of roles and goals to create the following mission statement. My mission is to live with integrity and to make a difference in the lives of others. To fulfill this mission, I have charity, I seek out and love the one, each one, regardless of his situation. I sacrifice, I devote my time, talents, and resources to my mission. I inspire, I teach by example that we are all children of a loving Heavenly Father and that every Goliath can be overcome. I am impactful, what I do makes a difference in the lives of others. These roles take priority in achieving my mission. Husband, my partner is the most important person in my life. Together we contribute the fruits of harmony, industry, charity, and thrift. Father, I help my children experience progressively greater joy in their lives. Son/brother, I am frequently there for support and love. Christian, God can count on me to keep my covenants and to serve His other children. Neighbor, the love of Christ is visible through my actions toward others. Change agent, I am a catalyst for developing high performance in large organizations. Scholar, I learn important new things every day. Writing your mission in terms of the important roles in your life gives you balance and harmony. It keeps each role clearly before you. You can review your roles frequently to make sure that you don't get totally absorbed by one role to the exclusion of others that are equally or even more important in your life. After you identify your various roles, then you can think about the long-term goals you want to accomplish in each of those roles. We're into the right brain again, using imagination, creativity, conscience, and inspiration. If these goals are the extension of a mission statement based on correct principles, they will be vitally different from the goals people normally set. They will be in harmony with correct principles, with natural laws, which gives you greater power to achieve them. They are not someone else's goals you have absorbed. They are your goals. They reflect your deepest values, your unique talent, your sense of mission. And they grow out of your chosen roles in life. An effective goal focuses primarily on results rather than activity. It identifies where you want to be, and, in the process, helps you determine where you are. It gives you important information on how to get there, and it tells you when you have arrived. It unifies your efforts and energy. It gives meaning and purpose to all you do. And it can finally translate itself into daily activities so that you are proactive, you are in charge of your life, you are making happen each day the things that will enable you to fulfill your personal mission statement. Roles and goals give structure and organized direction to your personal mission. If you don't yet have a personal mission statement, it's a good place to begin. Just identifying the various areas of your life and the two or three important results you feel you should accomplish in each area to move ahead gives you an overall perspective of your life and a sense of direction. As we move into habit 3, we'll go into greater depth in the area of short-term goals. The important application at this point is to identify roles and long-term goals as they relate to your personal mission statement. These roles and goals will provide the foundation for effective goal setting and achieving when we get to the habit 3 day-to-day management of life and time. Family mission statements. Because habit 2 is based on principle, it has broad application. In addition to individuals, families, service groups, and organizations of all kinds become significantly more effective as they begin with the end in mind. Many families are managed on the basis of crises, moods, quick fixes, and instant gratification, not on sound principles. Symptoms surface whenever stress and pressure mount. People become cynical, critical, or silent, or they start yelling and overreacting. Children who observe these kinds of behavior grow up thinking the only way to solve problems is flight or fight. The core of any family is what is changeless, what is always going to be their shared vision and values. By writing a family mission statement, you give expression to its true foundation. This mission statement becomes its constitution, the standard, the criterion for evaluation and decision-making. It gives continuity and unity to the family as well as direction. When individual values are harmonized with those of the family, members work together for common purposes that are deeply felt. Again, the process is as important as the product. The very process of writing and refining a mission statement becomes a key way to improve the family. Working together to create a mission statement builds the PC capacity to live it. By getting input from every family member, drafting a statement, getting feedback, revising it, and using wording from different family members, you get the family talking, communicating, on things that really matter deeply. The best mission statements are the result of family members coming together in a spirit of mutual respect, expressing their different views, and working together to create something greater than any one individual could do alone. Periodic review to expand perspective, shift emphasis or direction, amend or give new meaning to time-worn phrases can keep the family united in common values and purposes. The mission statement becomes the framework for thinking, for governing the family. When the problems and crises come, the constitution is there to remind family members of the things that matter most and to provide direction for problem-solving and decision-making based on correct principles. In our home, we put our mission statement up on a wall in the family room so that we can look at it and monitor ourselves daily. When we read the phrases about the sounds of love in our home, order, responsible independence, cooperation, helpfulness, meeting needs, developing talents, showing interest in each other's talents, and giving service to others, it gives us some criteria to know how we're doing in the things that matter most to us as a family. When we plan our family goals and activities, we say, in light of these principles, what are the goals we're going to work on? What are our action plans to accomplish our goals and actualize these values? We review the statement frequently and rework goals and jobs twice a year, in September and June, the beginning of school and the end of school, to reflect the situation as it is, to improve it, to strengthen it. It renews us, it recommits us to what we believe in, what we stand for. Organizational mission statements. Mission statements are also vital to successful organizations. One of the most important thrusts of my work with organizations is to assist them in developing effective mission statements. And to be effective, that statement has to come from within the bowels of the organization. Everyone should participate in a meaningful way, not just the top strategy planners, but everyone. Once again, the involvement process is as important as the written product and is the key to its use. I am always intrigued whenever I go to IBM and watch the training process there. Time and time again, I see the leadership of the organization come into a group and say that IBM stands for three things: the dignity of the individual, excellence, and service. These things represent the belief system of IBM. Everything else will change, but these three things will not change. Almost like osmosis, this belief system has spread throughout the entire organization, providing a tremendous base of shared values and personal security for everyone who works there. Once I was training a group of people for IBM in New York. It was a small group, about 20 people, and one of them became ill. He called his wife in California, who expressed concern because his illness required special treatment. The IBM people responsible for the training session arranged to have him taken to an excellent hospital with medical specialists in the disease. But they could sense that his wife was uncertain and really wanted him home where their personal physician could handle the problem. So they decided to get him home. Concerned about the time involved in driving him to the airport and waiting for a commercial plane, they brought in a helicopter, flew him to the airport, and hired a special plane just to take this man to California. I don't know what costs that involved, My guess would be many thousands of dollars. But IBM believes in the dignity of the individual. That's what the company stands for. To those present, that experience represented its belief system and was no surprise. I was impressed. At another time, I was scheduled to train 175 shopping center managers at a particular hotel. I was amazed at the level of service there. It wasn't a cosmetic thing. It was evident at all levels, spontaneously, without supervision. I arrived quite late, checked in, and asked if room service were available. The man at the desk said, "No, Mr. Covey, but if you're interested, I could go back and get a sandwich or a salad or whatever you'd like that we have in the kitchen." His attitude was one of total concern about my comfort and welfare. "Would you like to see your convention room?" he continued. "Do you have everything you need? What can I do for you? I'm here to serve you." There was no supervisor there checking up. This man was sincere. The next day I was in the middle of a presentation when I discovered that I didn't have all the colored markers I needed. So I went out into the hall during the brief break and found a bellboy running to another convention. "I've got a problem," I said. "I'm here training a group of managers and I only have a short break. I need some more colored pens." He whipped around and almost came to attention. He glanced at my name tag and said, "Mr. Covey, I will solve your problem." He didn't say, "I don't know where to go," or, "Well, go and check at the front desk." He just took care of it. And he made me feel like it was his privilege to do so. Later, I was in the side lobby, looking at some of the art objects. Someone from the hotel came up to me and said, "Mr. Covey, would you like to see a book that describes the art objects in this hotel?" How anticipatory. How service-oriented. I next observed one of the employees high up on a ladder cleaning windows in the lobby. From his vantage point, he saw a woman having a little difficulty in the garden with a walker. She hadn't really fallen, and she was with other people. But he climbed down that ladder, went outside, helped the woman into the lobby and saw that she was properly taken care of. Then he went back and finished cleaning the windows. I wanted to find out how this organization had created a culture where people bought so deeply into the value of customer service. I interviewed housekeepers, waitresses, bellboys in that hotel and found that this attitude had impregnated the minds, hearts, and attitudes of every employee there. I went through the back door into the kitchen, where I saw the central value, uncompromising personalized service. I finally went to the manager and said, "My business is helping organizations develop a powerful team character, a team culture. I am amazed at what you have here." "Do you want to know the real key?" he inquired. He pulled out the mission statement for the hotel chain. After reading it, I acknowledged, "That's an impressive statement. But I know many companies that have impressive mission statements." "Do you want to see the one for this hotel?" he asked. "Do you mean you developed one just for this hotel?" "Yes." "Different from the one for the hotel chain?" "Yes. It's in harmony with that statement, but this one pertains to our situation, our environment, our time." He handed me another paper. "Who developed this mission statement?" I asked. "Everybody," he replied. "Everybody? Really, everybody?" "Yes." "Housekeepers?" "Yes." "Waitresses?" "Yes." "Desk clerks?" "Yes." "Do you want to see the mission statement written by the people who greeted you last night?" He pulled out a mission statement that they, themselves, had written that was interwoven with all the other mission statements. Everyone, at every level, was involved. The mission statement for that hotel was the hub of a great wheel. It spawned the thoughtful, more specialized mission statements of particular groups of employees. It was used as the criterion for every decision that was made. It clarified what those people stood for, how they related to the customer, how they related to each other. It affected the style of the managers and the leaders. It affected the compensation system. It affected the kind of people they recruited and how they trained and developed them. Every aspect of that organization, essentially, was a function of that hub, that mission statement. I later visited another hotel in the same chain, and the first thing I did when I checked in was to ask to see their mission statement, which they promptly gave me. At this hotel, I came to understand the motto "uncompromising personalized service" a little more. For a 3-day period, I watched every conceivable situation where service was called for. I always found that service was delivered in a very impressive, excellent way. But it was always also very personalized. For instance, in the swimming area, I asked the attendant where the drinking fountain was. He walked me to it. But the thing that impressed me the very most was to see an employee, on his own, admit a mistake to his boss. We ordered room service, and were told when it would be delivered to the room. On the way to our room, the room service person spilled the hot chocolate, and it took a few extra minutes to go back and change the linen on the tray and replace the drink. So the room service was about 15 minutes late, which was really not that important to us. Nevertheless, the next morning the room service manager phoned us to apologize and invited us to have either the buffet breakfast or a room service breakfast, compliments of the hotel, to in some way compensate for the inconvenience. What does it say about the culture of an organization when an employee admits his own mistake, unknown to anyone else, to the manager so that customer or guest is better taken care of? As I told the manager of the first hotel I visited, I know a lot of companies with impressive mission statements. But there is a real difference, all the difference in the world, in the effectiveness of a mission statement created by everyone involved in the organization and one written by a few top executives behind a mahogany wall. One of the fundamental problems in organizations, including families, is that people are not committed to the determinations of other people for their lives. They simply don't buy into them. Many times as I work with organizations, I find people whose goals are totally different from the goals of the enterprise. I commonly find reward systems completely out of alignment with stated value systems. When I begin work with companies that have already developed some kind of mission statement, I ask them, "How many of the people here know that you have a mission statement? How many of you know what it contains? How many were involved in creating it? How many really buy into it and use it as your frame of reference in making decisions?" Without involvement, there is no commitment. Mark it down, asterisk it, circle it, underline it. No involvement, no commitment. Now, in the early stages, when a person is new to an organization or when a child in the family is young, you can pretty well give them a goal and they'll buy it, particularly if the relationship, orientation, and training are good. But when people become more mature and their own lives take on a separate meaning, they want involvement, significant involvement. And if they don't have that involvement, they don't buy it. Then you have a significant motivational problem which cannot be solved at the same level of thinking that created it. That's why creating an organizational mission statement takes time, patience, involvement, skill, and empathy. Again, it's not a quick fix. It takes time and sincerity, correct principles, and the courage and integrity to align systems, structure, and management style to the shared vision and values. But it's based on correct principles and it works. An organizational mission statement, one that truly reflects the deep shared vision and values of everyone within that organization, creates a great unity and tremendous commitment. It creates in people's hearts and minds a frame of reference, a set of criteria or guidelines, by which they will govern themselves. They don't need someone else directing, controlling, criticizing, or taking cheap shots. They have bought into the changeless core of what the organization is about. Application suggestions. 1. Take the time to record the impressions you had in the funeral visualization at the beginning of this chapter. You may want to use the chart below to organize your thoughts. 2. Take a few moments and write down your roles as you now see them. Are you satisfied with that mirror image of your life? 3. Set up time to completely separate yourself from daily activities and to begin work on your personal mission statement. 4. Go through the chart in Appendix A showing different centers and circle all those you can identify with. Do they form a pattern for the behavior in your life? Are you comfortable with the implications of your analysis? 5. Start a collection of notes, quotes, and ideas you may want to use as resource material in writing your personal mission statement. 6. Identify a project you will be facing in the near future and apply the principle of mental creation. Write down the results you desire and what steps will lead to those results. 7. Share the principles of Habit 2 with your family or work group and suggest that together you begin the process of developing a family or group mission statement. Please refer to Appendix A. Habit 3. Put first things first. Principles of personal management. Things which matter most must never be at the mercy of things which matter least. Gouda. Will you take just a moment and write down a short answer to the following two questions? Your answers will be important to you as you begin work on Habit 3. Question 1, what one thing could you do, you aren't doing now, that if you did on a regular basis, would make a tremendous positive difference in your personal life? Question 2, what one thing in your business or professional life would bring similar results? We'll come back to these answers later. But first, let's put Habit 3 in perspective. Habit 3 is the personal fruit, The practical fulfillment of habits 1 and 2. Habit 1 says, you're the creator. You are in charge. It's based on the four unique human endowments of imagination, conscience, independent will, and, particularly, self-awareness. It empowers you to say, that's an unhealthy program I've been given from my childhood, from my social mirror. I don't like that ineffective script. I can change. Habit 2 is the first or mental creation. It's based on imagination, the ability to envision, to see the potential, to create with our minds what we cannot at present see with our eyes, and conscience, the ability to detect our own uniqueness and the personal, moral, and ethical guidelines within which we can most happily fulfill it. It's the deep contact with our basic paradigms and values and the vision of what we can become. Habit 3, then, is the second creation, the physical creation. It's the fulfillment, the actualization, the natural emergence of habits 1 and 2. It's the exercise of independent will toward becoming principle-centered. It's the day in, day out, moment by moment doing it. Habits 1 and 2 are absolutely essential and prerequisite to habit 3. You can't become principle-centered without first being aware of and developing your own proactive nature. You can't become principle-centered without first being aware of your paradigms and understanding how to shift them and align them with principles. You can't become principle-centered without a vision of and a focus on the unique contribution that is yours to make. But with that foundation, you can become principle-centered, day in and day out, moment by moment, by living habit 3, by practicing effective self-management. Management, remember, is clearly different from leadership. Leadership is primarily a high-powered, right-brain activity. It's more of an art, it's based on a philosophy. You have to ask the ultimate questions of life when you're dealing with personal leadership issues. But once you have dealt with those issues, once you have resolved them, you then have to manage yourself effectively to create a life congruent with your answers. The ability to manage well doesn't make much difference if you're not even in the right jungle. But if you are in the right jungle, it makes all the difference. In fact, the ability to manage well determines the quality and even the existence of the second creation. Management is the breaking down, the analysis, the sequencing, the specific application, the time-bound left-brain aspect of effective self-government. My own maxim of personal effectiveness is this: manage from the left, lead from the right. The power of independent will. In addition to self-awareness, imagination, and conscience, it is the fourth human endowment, independent will, that really makes effective self-management possible. It is the ability to make decisions and choices and to act in accordance with them. It is the ability to act rather than to be acted upon, to proactively carry out the program we have developed through the other three endowments. The human will is an amazing thing. Time after time, it has triumphed against unbelievable odds. The Helen Kellers of this world give dramatic evidence to the value, the power of the independent will. But as we examine this endowment in the context of effective self-management, we realize it's usually not the dramatic, the visible, the once-in-a-lifetime, up-by-the-bootstraps effort that brings enduring success. Empowerment comes from learning how to use this great endowment in the decisions we make every day. The degree to which we have developed our independent will in our everyday lives is measured by our personal integrity. Integrity is, fundamentally, the value we place on ourselves. It's our ability to make and keep commitments to ourselves, to walk our talk. It's honor with self, a fundamental part of the character ethic, the essence of proactive growth. Effective management is putting first things first. While leadership decides what first things are, it is management that puts them first, day by day, moment by moment. Management is discipline, carrying it out. Discipline derives from disciple, disciple to a philosophy, disciple to a set of principles, disciple to a set of values, disciple to an overriding purpose, to a superordinate goal or a person who represents that goal. In other words, if you are an effective manager of yourself, your discipline comes from within. It is a function of your independent will. You are a disciple, a follower, of your own deep values and their source. And you have the will, the integrity, to subordinate your feelings, your impulses, your moods to those values. One of my favorite essays is The Common Denominator of Success, written by E.M. Gray. He spent his life searching for the one denominator that all successful people share. He found it wasn't hard work, good luck, or astute human relations, though those were all important. The one factor that seemed to transcend all the rest embodies the essence of habit 3, putting first things first. The successful person has the habit of doing the things failures don't like to do, he observed. They don't like doing them either necessarily. but their disliking is subordinated to the strength of their purpose. That subordination requires a purpose, a mission, a habit, a clear sense of direction and value, a burning yes inside that makes it possible to say no to other things. It also requires independent will, the power to do something when you don't want to do it, to be a function of your values rather than a function of the impulse or desire of any given moment. It's the power to act with integrity to your proactive first creation. Four generations of time management. In Habit 3, we are dealing with many of the questions addressed in the field of life and time management. As a longtime student of this fascinating field, I am personally persuaded that the essence of the best thinking in the area of time management can be captured in a single phrase: organize and execute around priorities. That phrase represents the evolution of three generations of time management theory, and how to best do it is the focus of a wide variety of approaches and materials. Personal management has evolved in a pattern similar to many other areas of human endeavor. Major developmental thrusts, or waves as Alvin Toffler calls them, follow each other in succession, each adding a vital new dimension. For example, in social development, the agricultural revolution was followed by the industrial revolution, which was followed by the informational revolution. Each succeeding wave created a surge of social and personal progress. Likewise, in the area of time management, each generation builds on the one before it, each one moves us toward greater control of our lives. The first wave or generation could be characterized by notes and checklists, an effort to give some semblance of recognition and inclusiveness to the many demands placed on our time and energy. The second generation could be characterized by calendars and appointment books. This wave reflects an attempt to look ahead, to schedule events and activities in the future. The third generation reflects the current time management field. It adds to those preceding generations the important idea of prioritization, of clarifying values, and of comparing the relative worth of activities based on their relationship to those values. In addition, it focuses on setting goals, specific long, intermediate, and short-term targets toward which time and energy would be directed in harmony with values. It also includes the concept of daily planning, of making a specific plan to accomplish those goals and activities determined to be of greatest worth. While the third generation has made a significant contribution, people have begun to realize that efficient scheduling and control of time are often counterproductive. The efficiency focus creates expectations that clash with the opportunities to develop rich relationships, to meet human needs, and to enjoy spontaneous moments on a daily basis. As a result, many people have become turned off by time management programs and planners that make them feel too scheduled, too restricted, and they throw the baby out with the bathwater, reverting to first or second generation techniques to preserve relationships, spontaneity, and quality of life. But there is an emerging fourth generation that is different in kind. It recognizes that time management is really a misnomer. The challenge is not to manage time, but to manage ourselves. Satisfaction is a function of expectation as well as realization. And expectation and satisfaction lie in our circle of influence. Rather than focusing on things and time, fourth generation expectations focus on preserving and enhancing relationships and on accomplishing results, in short, on maintaining the P/PC balance. Quadrant 2. The essential focus of the fourth generation of management can be captured in the time management matrix diagrammed on the next page. Basically, we spend time in one of four ways. As you can see, the two factors that define an activity are urgent and important. Urgent means it requires immediate attention. It's now. Urgent things act on us. A ringing phone is urgent. Most people can't stand the thought of just allowing the phone to ring. You could spend hours preparing materials, you could get all dressed up and travel to a person's office to discuss a particular issue, but if the phone were to ring while you were there, it would generally take precedence over your personal visit. If you were to phone someone, there aren't many people who would say, "I'll get to you in 15 minutes, just hold." But those same people would probably let you wait in an office for at least that long while they completed a telephone conversation with someone else. Urgent matters are usually visible. They press on us, they insist on action. They're often popular with others. They're usually right in front of us. And often they are pleasant, easy, fun to do. But so often they are unimportant. Importance, on the other hand, has to do with results. If something is important, it contributes to your mission, your values, your high priority goals. We react to urgent matters. Important matters that are not urgent require more initiative, more proactivity. We must act to seize opportunity, to make things happen. If we don't practice habit 2, If we don't have a clear idea of what is important, of the results we desire in our lives, we are easily diverted into responding to the urgent. Look for a moment at the four quadrants in the time management matrix. Quadrant I is both urgent and important. It deals with significant results that require immediate attention. We usually call the